Hello, I'm Ursie Downs, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries. The aim of Greater Than 11% is to increase diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. As you've probably already established, this week's episode is going to be slightly different to the episodes you've previously heard. And that is because this week I have the great pleasure of interviewing the founder and host of Greater Than 11% herself, Renee Vaughan Sutherland. Renee and I have worked together for 3 years, and whilst I know quite a bit about Renee's career journey so far and her aspirations for the future, I'm so excited to hear her talk about this more. In fact, I've been pushing her to agree to do this episode since she started the podcast a year ago. Renee is a creative force to be reckoned with, an incredible team leader, and a loyal and dedicated friend. She has been a consistent inspiration to me since I started as an assistant producer 3 years ago, and in fact, was the reason that I got my job at Hub in the first place. Renee initially challenged herself to create 52 episodes of Greater Than 11%, and this very special episode marks the end of series one and is the 53rd episode created to date. So without further ado, Renee, welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you, Ursie.
It's so nice to have you here.
It's great to be here, kind of. I'm slightly nervous being on the other side of the interview, but yeah.
It's going to be great. I'm excited to hear all about your career, and it's going to be a good episode. So, can you start by telling me about your career journey from when you began up until now?
Okay, so I do need to say quite up front that I've had many career lives. So, stick with me, people, because it's going to be a bit of a journey. So I started out initially in hospitality. I moved out of home when I was 16 and put myself through school. And I had this fabulous job on a Wednesday night where I would go to the police headquarters in central Brisbane and I would wash a million and one pots that the kitchen had been cooking all day for the police service. And I would go in, I think, at something like 5 or 6, and I would scrub, scrub, scrub. And then by 9 o'clock, it was sparkling clean. There's nothing like going somewhere that's like a shit storm, and then a few hours later, just be leaving, and it's just like,
oh, so
I
satisfying.
loved it. It was so good. And then on the weekend, I worked at the Queensland Museum as a kind of kitchen hand and a cashier in their cafe. And this job really opened my eyes because I was working with people that were all older than me, some European, some had from all different parts of Australia, and it really started opening up my world about difference and what was out there. I definitely had lived in quite a closed kind of viewpoint of the world up until that point. So I finished school and my plans and desires were to be a nurse. And that's what I've been working towards for kind of the last 3 years of my schooling life. And I missed out by 2 points. And that was totally gutting. And I went into this whole beating myself up and feeling like an absolute failure. And I didn't actually do anything about it. I just carried on working within hospitality. My job at the museum became a full-time job. I started becoming a supervisor quite quickly on, and I really loved it. But I think maybe after a year, probably a bit of pressure from my parents, a bit of pressure from myself as well, because I didn't want to work in hospitality forever. It was definitely not my dream. I saw apprenticeships being advertised within different sectors. So I think one was in real estate, one was in law, one probably was in some kind of commercial arm. And I applied and I was successful to get a job with a small law firm. When I say small, it definitely was small. It was 4 people, including myself. It was one solicitor, an accounts secretary, and then my role was a conveyancing and law clerk, which I had no idea what was until I applied for the job. And then this involved a one day release going to business school, which I quickly discovered was secretary school, which was kind of odd because I had no desire whatsoever to be a secretary. But took it on full force, gusto, learned how to type, learned 93 words a minute, which probably not far off still now, which I'm still proud of. But whilst I was at school, my main focus was art and sports. That's what I was like excelling in. So the thought of working in an office was a bit at odds. Started wearing power suits,
amazing.
which I, thought I was so grown up
This
again,
is
and
where the
I,
power dressing really began.
oh, it definitely began before that. That's another story, but yeah, I really enjoyed the job. I, as a conveyancing clerk, I was closing deals or doing property searches on commercial and domestic properties, and then I was also working with barristers sitting on the bench and passing them papers and things like that. And yeah, felt very grown up and really enjoyed it. Finished my kind of business school, stayed on at the firm. And this was based in the Valley in Brisbane, which is also known as Chinatown. And I again got another awareness of like different cultures and what was out there. My boss himself was Malaysian. And so I started also getting quite itchy feet, thinking, oh my gosh, there's a big world out there and I want to see it. You know, I want to be able to explore. And I'd always been a huge fan of traveling and had traveled a little bit in Australia and loved that. But I definitely had my sights set further afield. So after about a year at this law firm, I don't know if tragedy is the right word, but tragedy struck. Yeah. But what happened was the secretary who'd been there through an apprenticeship scheme herself, and I think had been with the firm for like 5, 6, 7 years, had been embezzling money for quite a long time. So she got the sack. They didn't want to report it to the police because they didn't want her to have a criminal record because they really cared about her. I saw her like a daughter. So I then had to do both roles, which was so stressful. And I was 19 at the time. And the emotional intensity of the situation, I did not have the skills to manage.
At 19 as well. I can't even imagine that level of stress being given two jobs.
It was super stressful, super stressful. And also, like, being a conveyancing law clerk, you're out of the office a lot.
Yeah.
So then having to come back and try and pick up all the work that was being generated within the office. And so I ended up resigning. And also at this point, I had decided I'm going off to travel the world. I'd also been working whilst at the law firm on a Saturday for the Youth Hostel Association. And I was on Saturdays working there to do bookings for youth hostels across Europe on an old dial-up modem system way before the internet was accessible within households. And I worked with two amazing women, one really tough but really kind and one really gentle woman. And they really shaped me. They helped me really understand about kind of good etiquette within an office, encouraged me to travel. They had traveled loads, you know, they're both travel agents. So I kept that job going and then I got a job as a receptionist. And I don't know whether it's because I knew I was going to be leaving, but it was like the best job in the world. I loved this job. I just excelled at everything I did. Like, I think I was just a bubble of energy. The clients loved me. Suppliers loved me.
Oh, that sounds great.
It was so good. My bosses, I was there 10 months in total, and I got 3 pay rises in 10
Amazing.
Months. Yeah, because I just got so much feedback. And that really set me up for life, and I think it's really important to state that for anyone that's listening, is that you should be rewarded for good work and good service, and actually, that has become a given for me. I have never been afraid for asking for pay rises as a result. So they did me a massive favour. So towards the end of that 10 months, I've been looking quite proactively for an au-pair job in France.
And was it always France you were thinking about when you were booking these youth hostels?
Absolutely. And it's definitely got something to do with my name. I think people, when I was growing up, would be like, oh, Renee, where does that come from? And I had no idea. But so this kind of pull, just because of my own name.
It was meant to be.
Yeah. I dreamt about going to France since I was a young girl. That's where my heart was set on. So I got a job in Paris, was set to go, and a couple of months beforehand it fell through. And I was absolutely gutted. It's that real frustration when you just want to leave and see the world, etc. And then my trip was then delayed a little bit. And then I got another job with a family in Toulouse and left Australia in 1996 in November. Arrived in France. I'd never left Australia before. Never even been on a plane before. So it was like literally a whole new world.
Were you scared?
I wasn't scared.
Excited?
I loved it. It was incredible. And the family that I worked with was so lovely. And it was 2 kids. And really all they needed help with was walking the kids to school, picking them up after and cooking dinner. So I had loads of time to myself to write, to read. I started drawing and painting again, something I hadn't done for a few years. And it was a really great time of introspection because whilst I was in Brisbane, I'd been such a social butterfly. I'd had so many social groups. I was out every night. I couldn't go anywhere without bumping into another group. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I knew no one. And I got to just really be. And I loved that. It was such a great year. And I just loved my family. And I traveled all over France. And that was fabulous. Sadly, my visa was for a year. I couldn't extend it. And so I came to the UK. And I came to the UK because my parents are English and I could get residency here. I came with literally $200 or £100 that my younger brother had lent me because I had spent all my cash. So I was like, okay, I need a job. What can I do that will give me accommodation and also a decent wage? So I should say that before I moved out of home, I was the resident babysitter in our area. And then when I did move out of home, I was working with youth groups, primarily focused on children from single-parented families, because that's what my background was as well. So I got offered two jobs and I took the job with a family who had an autistic son and two younger brothers. And I was going to be his primary carer and he was seven. And this was like an incredible job. I felt so connected to this gorgeous boy who, when I met him, had gone through an understanding that he was different from everyone else he was around. He'd been self-harming. His legs were black and blue because he'd been biting himself constantly when he was frustrated because he had very low communication levels. And it was a very intense job. The children were a delight. The parents were tough. I was putting in place boundaries at that age and still figuring it all out. But after 14 months, and I was actually getting close to burnout, it was like 6 day a week job. I was living in the same house, the same floor as the whole family. It was exhausting.
So massively stark difference between your life in England and France then, where you had so much time to kind of explore and be your own person in France, and then coming to England where all of a sudden it's work, work, work.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then the family were going back to America. And they wanted me to go, but I just thought, actually, it's a lovely clean break because I can leave without actually leaving. It makes sense. The children will understand why I haven't come, etc. And I have to say that whilst I had this job, I didn't really have a chance to meet other people. And so I thought, well, as much as I'm not loving London, I haven't really given it a chance because I've been in this bubble of this family. I'll go back and get some office work and maybe meet people that way. And so I joined an agency, got a job as an administrator in an older person's social care team. And this has set me on a career path that I had no idea. I loved the job, absolutely loved it. I was working with so many incredible, passionate people who really cared about protecting our society's vulnerable people. And my role was to make sure that all the data was being collated and put in a system so we could see the care that was being provided, gaps in the service, and how to make improvements. I'm a big fan of data. I love data. And I loved these people. I was a team of about 20. And I made sure everyone's data was up to date, helping people, creating system, creating manuals, really showed them how to do it. And as a result, after the first quarter, our team popped up with this like amazing statistics. And as a result, I caught the eye of the IT and data department. So I continued in this job maybe for about a year, 18 months. Meanwhile, being able to go off and travel for chunks of time because it was still through an agency, and I would go off and they would be desperate to have me back. So it worked really well in my favor. And then after about that 18 months, someone within the IT and data department was going on maternity leave and they asked me to apply for that role, which I got. It was a project officer role for adult social care. So I went from one team to about 20 teams. So all the different teams within adult care. So older people, adults, which is like 16 to 64, mental health, people with learning disabilities, etc. And the social butterfly was able to be reignited, and I would go around to about all these 20 different teams, work with them and make sure they got their statistics up. It was such a great job. And with that data, we then were designing a new information system for collation of data, bespoke to the borough. And that was fascinating. And I loved that because I knew what information needed to be captured. And then I also knew how people worked and the difficulties of doing the job, but then coming back and putting the information into the system. So after about 18 months, we'd designed, had a system made. Our statistics for adult social care were doing better and better. But I started getting super itchy feet. I was like, I'm really good at this job. I'm really enjoying it. There's no room for growth. I could only go to my boss's job, which I didn't really want, and he wasn't going anywhere. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go off traveling again. I'm going to take 3 months off, and off I go. So I'd given my notice in, and at that time, because we'd become this exemplar borough in terms of statistical information, other boroughs were coming to look at our processes and how we'd managed this and the system we'd built. And pretty much, I think, weeks before I was about to go, a woman from a particular borough came and she was like, oh, this is amazing. We're about to create a new system. What are you up to? And I was like, oh, I'm actually leaving. I'm going off traveling. And she's like, well, look, when you come back, if you want a job, give me a call. So off I went traveling from Sweden all the way down to Sicily over 3 months. But actually, my first stop was Sweden. And when I got there, I was in Stockholm for a bit and I went to see an exhibition there and I saw some video art. And it's going to sound really arrogant. I'm cringing hearing myself saying it. But I was like, I could do better than this. And actually, I probably need to start focusing on my creativity more. Because I'd always still been taking photographs, still drawing, still painting from time to time, but hadn't been able to find a way to incorporate it more within my daily life as a daily practice, as a career as such. So I then caught a boat out to the archipelago, was on an island by myself for about 4 days, sitting, listening to Daft Punk often, watching sunsets into forests or into the water, rock climbing, picking wild strawberries.
Oh, sounds so perfect.
It was so lovely. Staying in a little hut that you literally put the money in a box because there was no one there to take the money for when you were staying.
Fantastic. I'd love to do that.
It was so, so good. It was so heavenly. And it was on many of those sunsets. In fact, I can see it, picture it right now. It's like when I made that decision, like, okay, you need to do something that's going to push you in a more creative career direction. And I was like, right, I think I'm going to go study art. So came back from travels. At the same time, I had just bought a boat as well to live on. And my friends had been staying on it whilst I was away and they'd actually damaged it. So when I got back, the two things I did was like, I need to fix the boat and I need to find out what I need to do to go study art. Found two art foundation courses, thought fantastic. Then I discovered the boat needed a lot of work and actually I financially couldn't afford to. Ugh. So with a little bit of bitterness with my friends, I called up the woman that had come to visit me before I'd left the previous council and said, yeah, I am looking for a job. Got an interview and got a job as a data analyst. It turns out actually the boat didn't need that much repair work and actually it was overquoted for. And at the time I was really annoyed at that. But what it did was it put off for a year going down that career path, but also building another, which is quite interesting. And actually the foundation course that I ended up on in Tower Hamlets at Poplar was incredible. And that wasn't in my first round. I hadn't discovered that. So it was meant to be.
Yeah.
In that year, though, whilst I was working for that borough, again, tragedy struck. And within the first kind of 2-3 weeks, the project manager resigned or was sacked. I was never quite sure. And they said to me, will you step up? Will you do it? And I knew I could do it because I had the experience. I might have needed a bit of support, maybe with budgets and things like that. But I said yes. I took on a team of 16. I was responsible for mapping out all the processes across both children and services and adult care. And it was great. I would go around and meet all these amazing people. I pulled them together. I mapped out all the processes, started designing a new IT system, working with an IT company, but all the while still focused on, well, in a year's time, I'm going off to do an art foundation. So towards the end of that year, I'd given in my notice, 2 months, and the whole council, but specifically social services, were getting outside consultants to come in to review all the work that was going on, not necessarily the project I was working on, the whole kind of structure. I think it was Deloitte or PwC, I can't quite remember. But they came in, I spent quite a lot of time with them because I knew all the processes of all the different kind of departments.
Wow, so just a little timeline check, how old were you at this point?
So I was 25.
25, wow, that's so impressive. All those teams working with these massive consultancy firms. Very confidence building.
It was confidence building. And I was often like having loads of self-doubt. Like, how am I doing? Like, why am I doing this? Like, all my managers and all the department heads were 15 to 20 years older. So I would sit on management boards and I was younger by minimum 15 years.
Good for you. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was. And it was really great because I then really started understanding, actually, I hold lots of the information here. That's what was in, and they would come to me for that. So that was definitely confidence building. And when they reported back to my head of department, they found out I was leaving, obviously. I said I was going off to study. And I'd been accepted by this point on the course at Tower Hamlets, which was a 3-day-a-week course, Monday to Wednesday. They basically said Renee's the linchpin to this whole project happening, and actually if you lose her, you're going to be set back potentially a whole year. So the head of department said to me, what could we do to make you stay? And I said, well, I'm definitely going to study, but I could do Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, if you're open to that. And they said, yep, that's not a problem. We want you to work in change management. You're really great at being able to take people with you and help them see changes being beneficial. Mm. And I really did love doing that. I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm going to mention another money point here because I think it's really important. They had recruited another project manager, and I knew he wasn't as good as I was. He was on paper, but actually I'd already started seeing his work. And so when they said to me, like, here's the job description, you need to fill it in a bit more for us and then tell us what you want to earn, I asked for the same wage as my boss. And my head of department laughed and said, you know, I can't do that. And so what I did was I negotiated a lesser rate, but then the remaining being made up in training. And it was such a smart move.
Clever.
Yeah. And the training was incredible. So I did lots more process mapping training. And I also then did some personality kind of testing and working out how different personality types operate, which I found fascinating. So off I went. I did my foundation course. I was doing my 3-day-a-week change management job for this council. Did my art foundation. Went on to then do a fine art degree at Middlesex. Initially was thinking I would do shoe design. That was my focus.
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, I was like,
having seen your shoe collection, that makes complete sense.
I know, so you've seen only a small amount of the ludicrous amount of shoes I have. So I was like, that is what I'm going to do. But my tutor on my foundation, Dawn, she was just like, that's not going to happen. You need to go study fine art.
There's still time.
Yes, it's highly likely I will design shoes at some point. But then as a result, the local authority again said, look, we still don't want to lose you. Could you still do some work for us? So whilst I did my degree, which is a full-time degree, I did that in 4 days. On Fridays, I would work for the council and also Saturdays. And I was highly organised. So on a Friday, I would have all my meetings. And Saturday, I would actually go back into the office, type up all my notes, do all my mapping, do kind of to-do lists for everyone, which then I would come back in and hold everyone really accountable on the Friday. And actually it worked super well because there was no wiggle room for anyone. They also knew that I was balancing and juggling a lot, and actually out of respect, they would just do it. So it worked really, really well.
That's incredibly impressive. I only had a retail job when I was at university, and I can't imagine how full on it must have been driving those kind of processes and making all of that happen alongside getting your degree. That's huge.
It was huge, but it was also a welcome break. Like when I went to university, I went as a grown-up, so I was 27 because I'd done my foundation in my 26th year, and I had this like real responsibility that I wasn't there 5 days a week, I was there four, so I really needed to commit, and I loved it. I loved it so much. You know, I would have been happy to study for the rest of my life. But sadly, I got to the end of my degree, and despite my job, I only had 10p in my bank account, and I was like, okay, I need to earn some money. You know, I started getting into debt, which I hate. I also had to do some repairs on the boat, and I was like, okay, I just need money.
Yeah.
I was back at uni after I graduated. It was the summer. I was going in using the edit stations until I was basically being pushed out the door. And one day one of the technicians said to me, look, I've been offered some work this weekend digitizing footage for a production company, but I can't do it. Do you want to do it? And I was like, yep, definitely want to do it. Didn't really know. I knew how to digitize tapes, but I was like, I need the cash.
Yeah.
I went in on the weekend, met David Hunstone, the founder and CEO of Hub. And that started a kind of working relationship over an extended period with Hub. At the same time, literally at the same time, I think the following week, my old boss at my former council called me up and said, I'm at a new borough now, and actually we need you. We need you to come and process map this. So I was like, yep, no problem.
I'm on it.
I'm on it. Process mapping, it's like the bat signal for me. So I was working during the day at that local authority and then working in the evening for Hub. I was doing 20-hour days. And I was so focused on, like, I need cash, I need to work it through, I need to get established, but then I'm going to focus on my career as an artist. Mm. And I think I was quite delusional in terms of what that was. I thought I would come out of university, I would work as an artist for a little bit, 6 months to a year. And then potentially a gallery would pick me up, put them in a stable, and I would then develop. And then maybe in 5-10 years, I would start becoming an established artist and being able to sell my work. That is not the reality. And that was like quite difficult to try and get my head around. I had not been prepared at university on any level. I think at university at that time, maybe it's different now, but it definitely was seen that you just skip out there and have loads of shows. In my mind, it was never going to be difficult. It might be a bit of a struggle, but it definitely wasn't going to be like, oh, like no one's interested. No one's interested in your work, and you've just graduated, so who is going to be interested in your work? And everyone's an artist these days. And so there's a lot of stuff that I had to kind of figure out.
Battle through.
Yeah. So I got to a point where I was like, okay, I shouldn't be working so much. I was getting quite tired. And my contract was coming to an end at the council. Even though they wanted me to stay, I was like, I really need to focus on moving into a more kind of creative career. So I started doing an edit assistant work for Hub. But at the same time, I also started working for arts institutions, so making kind of films for them. I started making video work for other artists. I also managed to make a documentary, which was incredible. I self-funded and self-directed it and made this feature-length documentary about Camden Arts Centre that screened at Camden Arts Centre and also the Rio Cinema in Dalston. I was still freelancing for Hub in this producer part-time role. By that point, I kind of grown up into the producer role. And then I was also starting to get group shows or commissions for work myself and was building that up. This kind of happened over maybe 5-6 years that I was kind of doing all these different elements at the same time and really, really juggling.
Did you get any sleep?
I've got a lot of energy, like, and I've got a lot of drive. So the answer's probably not a lot of sleep. So in about 2013-14, I just had a flurry of one show or project after another. And it was a really great period, which culminated in actually a solo show at Southend in Tap. And that was amazing. It was an incredible privilege to work on such a project like that. I just really, really loved it. And I really loved the work and the people that I worked with.
And an achievement for you at that point to get that.
Huge. And like, what an opportunity just to have the space to create. And it was in an old... it's called Tap because it's in an old waterworks pump house.
Yeah.
So it's the well underneath, and
incredible.
I'm not always attracted to gallery spaces. And so this was like this lovely, happy medium. And so I was juggling all that, and that was about 2015. And then 2016, I got an amazing opportunity for a show, a group show in Switzerland. And it was kind of like this 6-month residency of going out there, making the work with the community. And it ended up being 5 installation expanded cinema pieces. And it was a great project to work on, but I was kind of away quite a lot. And I came back from that, and Hub had called me up and said, you know, we'd love to have a meeting with you. Can you come in? And they kind of presented to me that they were expanding, definitely more into an agency, a bit more of a creative offering. And they were growing. They'd had significant, like, huge leap in terms of business that they were taking on board. And they said, we'd love you to be our chief creative officer. And everything they put to me, I just couldn't turn down. It was just, like, too much of a wonderful opportunity. And so, yeah, through that very long and winding path, this is where I am now.
This is where we are now. That is amazing. And is there any part of you that ever kind of looks back at your life with Process Maps and thinks, oh, I actually missed that? Or,
well, I think as a chief creative officer, like, you have to be super strategic. And process mapping, especially when I was taught how to process map, like, it was like how my brain thinks laid out in paper.
Yeah.
So, like, I think like that. And we've worked together. Like, project management for me, I can see dates and timelines in my head and easily be able to pick up things and swap around. So,
yeah, I'm so good at that.
I wouldn't say I miss it, but I do use it all the time, in a different way.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. So could you talk to me about your role as a creative director and the creative vision that you have for your team?
So my role as a creative director is actually such a great job. And as I mentioned, I'm actually the chief creative officer, but I do find that term a little bit exaggerated on a daily basis. And on a day-to-day, I am doing a lot of creative direction, mainly because we're a small team. We're about 25 in total at Hub. So the creative team made up of producers, assistant producers, editors, edit assistants, and then we have a roster of freelance motion graphic designers and animators. So that's the way it's structured. When I was offered the role, I had a really clear vision about creativity. So I am really passionate about a creative life and living creativity through everything you do. And I definitely try and immerse the creative team in that. So four kind of strategies I had when I first came in was the creative Chow, Wow, Now and How series. And it's so much fun. And that's not just for the creative team. It's actually open to the whole of the agency. And so creative Chow, as you well know, is we have a Pinterest board each month. Everyone can share things they're watching, things that have inspired them, things they're curious how they're made. Then once a month, we meet for lunch, hub by everyone lunch. We sit as a huge team and we share what we've been looking or what we've been thinking about. And then we discuss it. We may ask the technical people, so the animators may be like, how was that made? And then it's a really great way to facilitate creative sharing, creative learning, and creating a culture. Like, culture is really important to me.
Oh, I love that. Yes. So much fun. And we learned so much about other people's tastes as well, and things that you just wouldn't have spotted otherwise that people are finding on YouTube or on the internet, or those niche places that you don't go to as yourself but actually enjoy when other people show them to you. It's
definitely
really cool.
And obviously the food. Often
the food is also
spinach
great.
And agushi, which we is a fan favourite within the
team. Fan favourite indeed.
And then there's Creative Wow. So Creative Wow is hub allocate budget for the team, again, the entire agency, to collectively organise going to events out of work hours. So potentially going to see, I don't know, a director talk about a film or go and see an art gallery or something like that. Creative Now is our internal newsletter. Happens bi-monthly and has all the projects we're working on. So all the producers, the different teams like the tech team and the Bombora team, they also contribute. So we're all kind of kept in the loop of what each other's up to, because in busy times, it's really hard to let each other know what's happening. And our senior designer, Rena, she oversees it, and she has got a very quirky vision for the way it flows and the end page. There's always some little...
Oh, we love the end page. She gets us all involved.
Yeah.
Favourite album was one of the most recents. That was great.
Baby Pictures.
Baby Pictures, also great. What animal would you be?
That's right, yeah. Oh. So loads of fun, and it's really great. And yeah, it's so nice when you see other people reading it and laughing. And yeah, it's just really
it brings us all together.
Yeah,
and it
does.
Gives you things to talk about with different teams that you wouldn't necessarily interact with them on a day-to-day basis, but you all end up having a laugh about it, and
yeah,
that's really nice.
It's true. And there's also interviews with new members to the team and also personal projects and things like that. So it's a great way to share. And then Creative How is an informal skill swap system. So if you see a skill someone else has got and you would like to learn it, you can hit them up basically and say, yep, can you give me a couple of hours and teach me that? So some have been more successful than others. Some have been really popular. Some have been slow burners. Others have just kind of really taken off. And that's kind of the vision I had for the team, that creativity is at the heart of everything we do. Like, I'm a huge believer that creativity is like the currency of the future.
Yeah.
It's the currency of the now. But as we go forward and more things are automated, it's going to be creativity that really is what's going to separate us
from robots.
Exactly. I really believe
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, me too.
And, you know, the robots are coming, people, so get creative.
Get creative right now.
So that's kind of been my vision for the team, is trying to facilitate an environment, a culture that inspires, gives people a chance to inspire as well, and also that we create great work. You know, even on those corporate jobs that aren't that exciting, that we do the best we can, we give our best creative focus and energy to.
And it's just so much fun and so exciting being a part of a team that you run. It's been amazing. So thanks.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. Thank you. I'm blushing now, as you can see.
That's all right. I'm probably so warm that I match the chair right now. So that's okay. So tell me what a typical day looks like for you.
So a typical day is a mix of everything. So I'm involved in new business. So I will often be coming up with concepts by myself or with the producers for new pitches. I will be overseeing creative direction on multiple projects. I will be managing the creative team. That's one-to-one management and team management, making sure that we're all on track. the Chow Wow Now How series gets thrown into that mix. And then I'm also involved with client management. So a lot of the bigger projects and the campaigns that we've been running for multiple years, I will be the face for that client just because that's been built over time and we have that relationship. So it's a mix of all those things, in addition to also working with the management team, thinking about strategy, thinking about forward projecting, how we're going to tackle, you know, issues coming up, Brexit, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So just a couple of things going on in your day.
It's a lot of plate spinning and it's a lot of having to think on your feet constantly. You can be planning to do one thing and then something else will come in. There's definitely a lot of firefighting.
And just reshuffling.
Yeah. Projects change, new things come in. Yeah.
And you still manage to be there a lot for your team, which is incredibly impressive considering the amount of work that you always have to do. I know that everyone always appreciates you just being around to offer help and support and advice, and I think you do a great job of balancing all of those things.
Thank you. It's very lovely to hear.
If you had one piece of advice for your younger self, what would that be?
So, Ursie, I am young.
Oh, no! Damn it. I said younger.
Okay. So I'm going to give you three things that I still tell myself now.
Because you're still young.
That's right. So one thing that I've definitely been on a journey on, especially creatively, and you mentioned me being a perfectionist before, and this feeds this thing that I need to keep reminding myself on. Don't fear failure and bounce back quicker and learn from it. Do not beat yourself up over your failings. Maybe lick your wounds a little bit, but pick yourself up and try again. And that might mean failing again. But really, especially in creativity, if you fear it, it's going to stop your potential.
That's an amazing piece of advice.
Number two, perfection strangles creativity. And that is true. And that I've had to learn that the hard way. Things don't need to be perfect. Things can be good enough. You know, you can really busy yourself constantly polishing and polishing and polishing. Meanwhile, there's other creative things you could be doing.
That's very true.
And then my third piece of advice to my youngish self is, if you're aware that you have an issue with something, confidence, self-sabotaging, emotional baggage, deal with it as soon as possible. That could be going through therapy, mindfulness, yoga, whatever. Proactively deal with it. Be brutally honest with yourself, not in an aggressive way, but really figure out what it is that's keeping you in these kind of repetitive, often negative cycles, unproductive patterns, because the sooner you start dealing with it, the sooner you can move forward, and the sooner you can move forward, more creative opportunities will present themselves.
How true is that? That is amazing advice. We might have to get t-shirts with those on.
For your younger self.
Younger. Not young. Younger. Oh no. I'm still red from when you said that. Okay. What has been one of the biggest challenges of your career?
So I've thought about this a lot, especially because I ask that of everyone that I interview. And I often go away and think about that after, because I think it's quite poignant. It can be a catalyst for people, or it can be something that really represses them. And I've spent, like I said, a lot of time thinking about everyone's answer. It's weird. That's the question that I am actually quite obsessed with when I ask people. So I'm quite a private person. So I'm going to preface this with that. I'm going to feel quite vulnerable saying this. But because I've had so many people be so open and honest when they've come on the podcast, like I feel like I can only be honest. So the biggest challenge I've faced and have to overcome is learning to like myself. And that is in relation to my career as well, because it impacts everything. It's quite toxic and quite poisonous, and it seeps into everything you do, your life, your career, your creativity, your relationships, with personal relationships, family, friendships, etc. So I think it's important to learn how to love yourself and remedy that quite proactively and really work towards that. And I would say that I'm definitely not out of the woods, but it's definitely been the biggest challenge in my life slash career.
That's so interesting to me because your confidence radiates from you most days. And I know that people are able to build up walls and ways of protecting themselves from others and not showing that. But yeah, I think you're right. It's a really difficult thing to overcome. You're a very strong person. I think what you said about you being private as well probably means that other people don't see that a lot of the time, or you don't allow people to.
Yeah, I don't. And, you know, and I've mentioned on this podcast, and actually she's also been a guest, but I have a best friend. She's been my best friend since I was 16. And I also have a small group of extremely close friends, and that is a wonderful thing in this life to have. It's not something that I would ever not want, but at the same time that affords you to be private. Like, those people know me so well, they know what I'm thinking, how I'm feeling, and I feel very secure in that, so I don't feel the need to open up. And I am a private person for many reasons, and I know a lot of those reasons why, but I wouldn't say I'm private in terms of not wanting to let people in.
Yeah,
it's because I feel I don't have to, because I'm super, super lucky. But again, you know, like, I also see that there's some disadvantages to that. That's part of overcoming that challenge.
Yeah, I really relate to that. Could you talk about your role as an artist outside of your day-to-day work and how you balance your time?
So balance.
This is you not sleeping again, isn't it?
I don't know balance in any shape or form. It's just not. I think as you're well aware, we got told off by Pat for my intro section being far too long. And in that narrative and that story, you know, there's not a lot of balance. There's a lot going on all the time. So being an artist isn't easy, as I've spoken about. And it's taken some time to kind of find my balance, find my feet, and work out how to survive, like have income that generates within a creative industry, but also find the time to do my own work, which is extremely important to me. But I've slowed down in that focus of like being an artist and self-sufficient artist, and I think that's actually been a positive thing. So for me, it's all about persistence. It's just consistency and doing. So whilst it might be slow, it's still happening. And actually integrating it into my life as a whole. So I've talked about this on the podcast with different people as well. Helena Gaunt is someone I definitely remember speaking to this about, is like having these different silos. So here's my artistic practice. Here's my work that I'm doing within media and agency. Here's maybe this other strand, and keeping them all separate. And actually that was really exhausting. And I definitely weighted them. So artistic career was the kind of high aspiration. You know, a career in the media and agency, well, you know, it's kind of what I have to do. It is being creative, but it's not the creativity I want. And actually, that's super dysfunctional. And I definitely have to thank my therapist, but I also have to thank my amazing mentor, Simon White, for helping me be able to reconcile and bring all the creativity into one place. Oh my God, that's been so freeing.
I bet.
So my own creativity, what I've been working on primarily over the last year, and my weekends, I work, and my holidays, I work. I don't go away without having a project. I don't have a weekend where I won't allocate a certain amount of time to work. And if I don't, I'll get really depressed. You know, like, I'm driven by that and I am fueled by that. And it, like, I have that purpose and I'm a driven by purpose person. So the last year I've been writing a script, and it's quite a heavy and weighty emotional script, and it's for a feature film that is a slow burn. And that is something I want to do. I've also been working on a photography project. And then when I don't feel like doing those things, I make collage. And I love collage. I make a lot of them. They don't see the light of day, apart from those that I love get them. Oh. And I have wadges and wadges of these. And yeah, I find it very therapeutic to take imagery, contemporary imagery, and rearrange it and create different narratives. So that is kind of how I find the time. It's just making sure that I rinse every minute out of every day that I can. Yeah, without burning out as well. That's where balance is really important. So I shouldn't laugh in the face of balance.
You have a true creative life.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Who do you look up to creatively?
So Derek Jarman, he's my self-appointed godfather. I love him. I love his work. I love his activism. And I did have a period in my life where he would come and talk to me in my dreams. And I so miss him. He hasn't visited for a while.
Come on, Derek.
Please. So I feel strongly connected to Derek Jarman. There's just, his filmmaking especially, and his diaries. I love reading. Dungeness, where he lived. I go on pilgrimage, you know, 2 or 3 times a year. I feel, this affinity with him. So I would say he's definitely someone I look up to creatively. Tacita Dean is an incredible artist. I look up to her a lot. I think she's incredibly sophisticated in her thinking, her art making, her writing. I just think she's such a significant and phenomenal artist of our generation now. And I love that. Her work, it just stops me in my tracks. I feel quite connected to Chantal Ackerman's work. There's the fantastic Kathy Cavalier. She's an Australian artist who's also passed. There's Helen Chadwick. I love her sculptures. Louise Bourgeois, firm favourite of many people, I think. I know there's a list of like this never-ending incredible artists, and I will be kicking myself for not mentioning other people later on. But film-wise, I love Ingmar Bergman, Andrei Tarkovsky, Wim Wenders, Werner Herzog, Kenneth Anger, Maya Duran. And I mean, these are all creative and amazing people that are kind of removed from me. But then there's also people that I look up to personally as well. So there is the most incredible experimental poet who is like the most wonderful person in the world, Pascal Burton, previous Squid and 11% guest, if you want to look her up. Then there's cinematographer Anna Valdez-Hanks, again, another Squid and 11% guest. She is an amazing cinematographer. She is so driven, so passionate, and such a lovely person, and she completely inspires me. Then there's Penny Woolcock, who I didn't know very well before I did her interview, and I cried when I was editing, because she's so bloody amazing.
She is incredible.
She is phenomenal with her creativity and her creative life. Jackie Ryan, she's an author, comic creator, and bloody hilarious all-around woman. Kerry Nichols, Kasia Wozniak, and the list keeps going. And they're just podcast guests for Greater Than 11%. So, look, I look up to loads of people creatively. I just think anyone that's driven by creativity, even if it's not what you're into, it's hard not to look up to them.
Yeah, that's very true. And who inspires your work?
Derek Jarman, without a shadow of a doubt. You can definitely see a connection between me and Jarman. I would say cinematically, Ingmar Bergman. I definitely think you can see that in the work. In terms of performance, probably Chantal Ackerman. I definitely gravitate towards work that's situated kind of where it's made and formed from where it's made. I'm not a huge fan of the gallery. I actually like work to be outside and chance and happenstance, to be at play. So any work that kind of takes on those kind of mechanics always appeals to me and inspires me.
That's really interesting. And how do you fuel your creativity?
I watch a lot. I love watching people and observing behaviours. I am fascinated by people. I watch a lot of films. Although streaming services do corrupt that a little bit.
Yeah.
Too addictive.
Too addictive.
And can be a bit distracting, actually. And I am going through a phase where I am thinking about, okay, I'm going to need to be really purposeful in what I'm watching. Because I do believe what you put in is what you're pulling out as well.
Trash versus treasure.
Trash versus treasure. Oh, my God, you got it in. I love that. So Ursi and I have loads of conversations in the office about if something's trash or treasure, and that you need a bit of both.
You do. But sometimes you need a bit more treasure, and sometimes you need a bit more trash.
I guess it comes back to balance. When you don't have the headspace, trash is gold.
Agreed.
Hello, Queen of the South.
You just want to switch off just a little bit. Just want to be distracted just enough to get through the day. But you don't want to have to be thinking.
There is limits to trash, though, Ursi.
Oh, I knew this was coming.
I won't mention what you've been watching of recent.
It's just come to an end.
So I go to a lot of talks as well by artists. As you're aware, I'm out all the time when I can be. So artist talks, filmmaker talks, I go to exhibitions. But also actually what's really interesting for me is how I feel my creativity is going for walks. I've always been a big walker, and walking the landscape completely charges me. And I really do believe just going out and seeing water, seeing green, completely renews the creative vibes. And I have got the habit of wanting to just stay in my studio all day. And I have now got to the point where I know it's 6:30. If I've been working a good 7-8 hours, then I must go for a walk. And I literally have to parent myself like, you need to go for a walk now. You need to put something down, out you go. And then as soon as I'm out, I'm like, oh my God, this feels great. And I've got loads of energy and I'm thinking about new ideas. it's interesting that disconnect of wanting to keep working and actually probably not being very productive to going out and actually completely being refueled. So yeah, walking definitely inspires me. And any project that I have, any exhibition I have, always involves walking the landscape of where it's situated.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I find nature very inspiring. And I also find it very difficult to pull myself away from projects a lot of the time. I think sometimes you just feel like you need to keep battling on with things.
I'll just get this a little bit more. I'll just get this a little bit more. It's that trap, actually. And you, like I said, you're not being productive.
You've run out of steam anyway, and you're just there. Mm. Yeah, you're so right. So now that brings us to greater than 11%. So for anybody that hasn't heard any previous episodes, can you give us a bit of an overview of what inspired you to start greater than 11%?
Sure. So if you listen to the earlier episodes, there is definitely a long ramble at the beginning of those talking about why I started it. And the bottom line is I went to an event. In that event, they talked about a statistic that only 11% of women at that point in time were creative directors within the media industry. And whilst I've often worked in teams mostly made up of men, it actually gobsmacked me. It really stopped me in my tracks. And I was like, how is that even possible? Like, really, how is it even possible? And then I started thinking about, well, how would you change that? And at the end of this event, they challenged us saying, what are you going to do to make a difference in the industry? And I am not someone that you can say something like that to and that I'll just go, nothing. So I was like, oh, I almost rolled my eyes like, oh, you've said that, I have to do something now. So I went away and thought about it. And what's really important for me is I wanted to create something free. There's a lot of things out there that aren't free. And actually that creates a block for a start. And also probably 10 years ago when I'd finished university, I had no idea what a creative director was or a chief creative officer. I didn't know what those roles did or how I could pursue them or even to know to pursue them. And as you've heard from my very long and winding career lives path, I was like, well, if you don't know what you can aspire to be, then you can never be it. And so I wanted to create something that would improve diversity so that you could listen to it, think about it, access it free of charge, and also be inspired. And I also wanted to like big up women because there's so many awesome women out there that just go about being awesome and don't ever get shouted about. And so I love podcasts and I also had wanted to challenge myself because I don't like public speaking, although I seem to be not having a problem today.
I'm very glad.
And I was like, right, podcast is great. I didn't want to do anything video related because I was like, women are judged constantly on the way they look. Mm. And actually, I really wanted to create something where you just heard them talking about their career and what inspires them and where they're heading. And so, yeah, I created the podcast.
What a concept. And it has been amazing listening to all your episodes. And it's amazing that we're at 53.
Yeah, I can't believe that.
It's amazing. And how was the process of starting the podcast for you? I know you said that you don't love public speaking. How did you do it? And were there any kind of hurdles along the way that you needed to overcome or new skills that you needed to learn?
So in terms of technical skills, I didn't have a problem. You know, I'd been self-shooting, you know, creating films, doing things like that for a long time. It wasn't a stretch for me technically. And I had most of the equipment and also access to Hub's equipment. So the thing that I really had to overcome was speaking in public and also knowing that my voice, my thoughts, my performance was going to be out there. So as being a producer, you know, you often have to interview people, but you aren't included in the final output. So that notion of like, oh yeah, I'm putting myself out there. And that was a little scary. And also, I'm not confident in terms of delivery often. I should say that in the last year, I've had some training because I was really lucky to get the Future Leaders Award bursary. And that went towards getting some public speaking training, which, you know, was amazing and incredible. I've been doing the podcast weekly. There's no better training than throwing yourself
Absolutely.
In. And I also had an opportunity to talk at Gather, the Wackle Gather in May to 400 people.
So impressive.
So I've kind of really pushed myself way outside my comfort zone in the last year. So that's probably the challenge, that the hurdle that I had to overcome.
Yeah, it's been amazing. It's been amazing seeing you kind of gain confidence in it as well. Do you ever get nervous before interviewing anyone, and how do you tackle that?
I do get nervous. So if I'm meeting someone for the first time, so I haven't always met people. Sometimes we've just been email corresponding and someone else has recommended someone else, which is part of the podcast format. And if I hugely admire them, if I look at their work and I'm like, oh my God, this person's amazing. Look at all the incredible things they do. I can find that a bit nerve-wracking because I'm like, oh my God, don't forget how to speak. But, you know, I have a mini freak out and then I talk to Pat, who reassures me. Aww. And then off we go. And what I've really learned is don't overthink it. You know, just make sure you know what you're going to cover and then go in and don't try and second guess yourself. Just go with the flow.
That's great advice. What have been your top three moments of series one?
So I can only answer this question with the one other person who's been there with me from the beginning. So I'm going to ask Pat to come out of the booth and into the studio. Don't worry about the recording. It'll be fine. I'm serious. Come, Pat. I've even got a chair ready here for you. So why don't I start? Because I've just sprung this on you, mm-hmm. and I know how much you're not going to enjoy this.
Yeah.
So going to Rotterdam, or Rotters, as I like to call it, Team Rotters, Rena came with us, who is EPSIC's guest, and she's Hub Senior Designer, and we just got on the Eurostar, and off we went, and it was so much fun. We met Alexandra Zygmunt. She was wonderful. She was a wonderful guest. And yeah, we just wandered around Rotters.
Yeah.
And it was just really lovely.
Yeah, I think all the trips that we've had have been great. So Prague is a newer one. And also the Creative Equals event. I think going away and being out of the small studio that we're in is good, and experiencing new things and meeting new people and stuff like that. I think it's great.
Yep, so Creative Equals was second on my list. It was just amazing working with both of you because Ursi was also there, and that was the first time.
Fun.
You got involved with the podcast directly, apart from being a fabulous guest.
Thank you.
And we were just running all day.
Yeah, it was pretty mad, wasn't it?
And it was fun.
It
like
was
that,
really
that
fun.
Energy, you know, and you're recording just, sound bites or bits or interviews, and you're like, oh my God, this is gold. Yeah. And excited about being able to put it out, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
So much adrenaline. We were just kept running into that little room we had and looking at each other like, this is amazing.
There's not many times, I think, well, speaking for myself, but I don't know about you guys, that I'm happy to skip lunch. That was one of those times.
Didn't even need lunch.
No, I was happy.
Just fueled on adrenaline and creativity.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good day. So I've got a third one as well, and that's been working with you.
Oh,
yeah. God. No, it's true. I know you're going to love that. And you're like wanting to crawl out of this room. But it's true. And I really want to say that because you are so wonderful and so supportive. And you're no bullshit. And that's what I really love about you. And this podcast would not have happened and would not have been possible. And we would not have made it to 53 episodes had it not been for you. So thank you.
Thank you. It's been great, hasn't it?
It's been really good.
I'm going to crawl away now.
Do you want a tissue?
I will have a little cry in the,
it's gonna get cry
in the gallery. But thanks very much.
Oh, I'm just going to sit here and wait till he gets around the corner so I can see him crying. Oh, that was so nice.
Are you going to have a little cry?
Maybe. Well, maybe some more gin. Who knows? So, what has been your biggest learning from series one?
Just ask people.
And what's next?
Oh my God, I'm very excited about series two, because what isn't next? So planning is well underway, and I've really been focusing on the values and the mission of the podcast, increasing diversity across the board, and also like creativity being at the heart of potential change and collaboration and risk-taking. So definitely looking to expand it beyond the podcast. That is definitely part of what I'm focusing on, but it's also not just about me facilitating it. I want the purpose and the mission to be embedded into what is being created. So more people involved, more people learning and developing and connecting and being creative. So people, you've heard it here first. Ursi Downs is going to be a co-host in series two.
I'm so excited. Oh, that's going to be amazing.
So plans are still underway. And once we've figured that out and series two kicks off, then there'll be a lot more information about what's going to be coming next. But I definitely am super excited about the potential. My studio fall is lined with like reams and reams of different cards and notes and streams of activity and possibility.
And process maps.
Yeah, well, it's pretty much a process map. And yeah, I can't wait for it to all be realised.
I'm so excited. It's going to be fantastic. We've come to the end.
We have.
I can't believe it. We've come to the end of series one.
It's been so much fun. And again, thank you, Pat. You're absolutely awesome. Thanks, Urs, for getting involved always as a guest at Creative Equals, for harassing me to do this. I think pretty much from the beginning you were harassing to interview me.
Thank you for doing it in the first place. And I hope you know how incredibly inspiring you are, not just to us, but to so many people. And I just can't wait to work on Series 2 with you. It's going to be amazing.
It's going to be awesome. Thank you.
Thanks.